Hey everyone, and welcome back to Policy Punchline. Here at the show, we interview scholars, policymakers, and business executives on urgent issues and frontier ideas in our world today. I'm Princeton Junior James Cross, here with David Pegaro. Professor Sir Angus Deaton, winner of the 2015 Nobel Prize in Economics, is the Dwight D. Eisenhower Professor of Economics and International Affairs Emeritus and senior scholar here at Princeton University. He is the author of a number of books, including The Great Escape, Health, Wealth, and the Origins of Inequality, and the best-selling Deaths of Despair and the Future of Capitalism, co-authored with Anne Case. And most recently, Economics in America, an Immigrant Economist Explores the Land of Inequality. Professor Deaton, we're thrilled to have you on the show today.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
I wanted to start out with Economics in America. It's a slightly different book than much of your previous work. It focuses on economics as a profession, economists here in America, and specifically in relation to some of our national issues around inequality and health. What compelled you to analyze the profession itself? And could you describe for our listeners sort of the broad theses of the book?
Well, I think, as you probably know, this book grew out of a set of letters, sort of op-ed length pieces that I'd written every 6 months when I first came to America and sent back to the British Royal Economic Society to let them know what a weird place America was. And then some of those got a lot of traction one way or another, much to my surprise. And so there was pressure to bring them out in a book. And at some point, I sort of stapled them all together, and that was a mess. It didn't work. And so I spent the summer of, 2022, almost 2 years ago now, trying to put them together into a coherent form and around various themes. So one of them, which sort of got into the title, The Land of Inequality, and, you know, one of the working titles was Shock and Awe, which has perhaps been a little overused, but when I first came to America, and it's still true, I was awed by the amazing things that I find here. You know, the amazing economists, the great wealth, all the wonderful things that exist in America. At the same time, I was shocked by some of the things that America didn't have, like a safety net, for instance, or the sort of racial problems that exist here that didn't exist in England in anything like the same form. I'm very shocked by the healthcare system, which is a theme running through the book too. You know, when I was a kid, just months after I was born, the British National Health Service was founded, and it was this sort of cradle to grave, free at the point of use healthcare system. And my parents thought it was the most wonderful thing there'd ever been in the history of the planet, sort of idea. And, you know, it relieved them from all sorts of anxieties and advantages. And I got fed on powdered eggs and, you know, milk and orange juice and cod liver oil from the National Health Service. And you come here, you know, and it was just, how do you handle this system, which seemed sort of like a mess. And that has turned into themes of my work. But the profession, I think that you can find out about that in the last chapters. And that's something I'm very concerned about now, and I want to write more about, which is to what extent is the economics profession responsible or has any responsibility at all for the mess that America seems to find itself in today, you know, for these enormous polarization and divisions we have between the ruling class and the working people in America. And I do think that we have some responsibility for that. And I'm interested in trying to broaden economics in a way that would bring some of these things in, which are not always taught, at least in graduate school. You guys may do better. I suspect you get a wider range of offerings than the graduate students.
Those areas that, you know, the profession of economics could be expanded to include. You talk about in Economics in America, there are critics of the profession that say it's given us pretty much nothing over the past 50 years. And there are big fans of what economics has done for public policy. And you acknowledge both sides, and you say that economics generally, and many economists in particular, have several notable blind spots. And we want to get into the specifics, you know, health, inequality, foreign aid, But could you sort of outline some of the biggest blind spots that you see in the profession right now?
Well, I was very influenced by a recent book by Beth Pot-Berman on thinking like an economist. I mean, she's a sociologist, but she identifies the sort of cardinal sin of economics as being obsessed with efficiency. You know, we really want more of everything, and efficiency means we get it with the least possible resources. And I've always been very influenced throughout my career by Amartya Sen. And Amartya Sen, in an event I did with him maybe about 10 years ago, certainly before the pandemic, identified the sort of Robbins definition of economics, which many economists would still subscribe to, I think, which is, you know, the allocation of scarce resources among competing ends. I don't know how many times you've heard that in your time at Princeton. And that's almost the definition of economists. But there are other possible definitions. And, you know, Amartya Sen likes to talk about Pigou's definition, which is an enthusiasm for doing something about poverty and deprivation, as being an alternative way of thinking about that. Hayek, somewhat surprisingly, who we think of as one of the founders of neoliberalism and of libertarianism, quoted that quote from Pigou in his inaugural lecture at the University of London in the 1930s. So he was pretty sympathetic to that too. And then you have this quote of Keynes that I use in the book that we all see a lot of Keynes, read a lot of Keynes, but that was one I hadn't seen, which is he said the sort of economic political problem of mankind is to reconcile three things: efficiency, which is the one we've been focusing on, social justice, which is the second, and individual freedom, right? And, you know, he doesn't suggest that those three things are compatible. In fact, it is probably true that there's some sort of two out of three you could do, but it's sort of hard to do the other one. You know, if you have a lot of social justice, you have a lot of interference in personal liberty through taxes and through regulations and so on. If, on the other hand, you believe in free markets, one of the great strengths of the Chicago School of Economics was that it had these clear neoliberal, not neoliberal, libertarian underpinnings, that if you sort of let markets do what they do, then that was compatible with human freedom. And so I find it very helpful to think through these three things and to try to see it. And if you go back in economics, and you don't have to go back very far, you go back to Keynes or you go to Milton Friedman even, they thought seriously about philosophy and, you know, what we were trying to do and what economics was about. And, you know, go back to Adam Smith or John Stuart Mill, who no one could decide whether he was a philosopher or an economist. I mean, and the same true of Adam Smith. He was a professor of moral philosophy before he went off to tutor the young Duke of Buccleuch. So philosophy was deeply embedded in economics from the very beginning, and we've sort of lost that. And I think that's hurt economics. I think it's also hurt philosophy. That philosophy is much less interested in how the world works than I think it ought to be.
I wanted to actually jump off from the definition of economics as mitigating the poverty, the Pigou definition that you provided. And on the broadest scale, when we think about eliminating poverty, and you've thought a lot about eliminating poverty, and specifically global poverty, and in economics in America, you recount a vigorous exchange at the beginning of this century in academic circles and public policy circles between William Easterly and Jeffrey Sachs and a number of other notable international economists, sort of many of whom have passed through Princeton, by the way, over foreign aid and the right solutions for global poverty. I think one of the, so Easterly's book talks about the sort of travails of American economists and misadventures in the tropics. And is apparently a great read. It's on my list.
It is a great read. Make sure you read it.
I read your description of it, and I said I have to go read that after Economics in America. And what you argue there is that Easterly opened sort of a space in the public discourse for being critical of foreign aid in a way that was not sort of far right isolationist, but sort of a principled economic critique of foreign aid.
Sure.
Could you tell us what your main critiques of foreign aid are as it exists now, and what sorts of foreign aid you think would be effective?
Okay. And this is a really good question to talk about with you guys, because it's something that, you know, undergraduates often want to, you know, they want to do good in the world. And you've got these effective altruism guys breathing down your neck and wanting you to give up, you know, some fraction of your income, and they want to turn you into Sam Bankman-Fried, though I guess that particular thing has lost its luster a little bit. But Easterly and I, and he's a good friend, don't differ from the aid advocates in terms of our concern for the poor of the world, right? So we're not talking about hard-hearted people who say, you know, the poor can look after themselves. I saw a quote I read yesterday by Sumner, who was a very libertarian economist and philosopher at Yale, who said, you know, when you see someone down in the, drunk in the gutter, that's exactly where they ought to be. So that's the sort of hard-hearted approach. And we don't take that. We think, you know, and there is a lot of poverty in the world. There are a lot of people who are suffering. There are a lot of kids who are dying before they should die. You know, young, not making it to their fifth birthday. So the question that's at issue here is, what can we really do to help? And that's where the differences are. So, you know, Jeff Sachs has this very technical set of solutions, which has its descendants today in Silicon Valley and Bill Gates and so on, which is, you get out there, use technology, we can educate these people up, and everything will be all right. And, you know, Bill and I are much more skeptical of that. And we think it's very easy to do harm as well as to do good. And part of that is a data exercise, which is, you look at the aid and you see where the aid has gone. And, you know, have those countries seem to benefit from it? That, of course, as you might imagine, is deeply controversial and difficult. And there's all sorts of econometric challenges there. But one fact I like to quote is that, you know, the two countries that have grown most rapidly are India and China. And they got almost no aid relative to the size of their economies. One of the odd things about aid donors is they like to split it among as many countries as possible. So small countries get a lot more aid per capita than big countries. And then the small countries have not notably grown more rapidly than. So I don't think you can make much of a case in general. There might be cases you can pick where you say aid really helped. But I think what the profession has come to realize is, in the end, this is all about politics. And basically, you can't get growth and sustained poverty reduction without some sort of pact between the government and the people in that country. And once you recognize that, that puts pretty severe limitations on what you can do from the outside. And, you know, one aspect of that is that many of the poorer countries in Africa are getting almost all of their government revenue from foreign aid, you know, and that makes the rulers responsive to the aid agencies and not to the people they ought to be responsive to, which is their own people. So it's that bargain that somehow a set of leaders who decide that, you know, plundering is not as profitable as building a development and growth strategy involving their own people, that triggers economic growth. And the question is whether you can do much from the outside. I think technical assistance can help. If I had my way, I would make something like the World Bank into a global public good, where, you know, you can have training schools for central bankers or something. How do you do this? You know, how do you handle your currency? There's a lot of technical assistance that people might want to know. How do you privatize a water system? You know, things like that. What's the best way to set up a legal system that's been deeply corrupted or something? And the bank does some of that. And I imagine that some of that is helpful. I also believe, and this is in my previous book, The Great Escape, You know, at the very end, what I say, I tell Princeton students who ask me this question is, you know, you have the standing to work at home. And there's lots of things we're doing at home, like trade barriers or something, that make it harder for poor countries to succeed than it ought to be. And that's a place where you have both legitimacy to act and the possibility of doing something. So that's what I tell people. If you want to do something, I was always very impressed. I have a friend in India called Jean Dres, who originally was Belgian. He's now an Indian citizen. He's worked with Amartya Sen over the years, and he's been an activist as well as a very, very fine economist. And he's an example of the other way to do it, which is you go there and become a citizen. You know, you throw in your lot with those people. And you give up your domestic citizen and so on. You take your skills, your intelligence, your Princeton economics training, whatever else, and you go and dedicate yourself to the cause. And that's what he's done. He keeps getting thrown in jail. He helps people. He's, you know, an activist, and he writes really good economics papers and books about what works and what doesn't work in India. So those are my two poles: stay home, help, or, you know, get absorbed into the country, which is hard to do.
Yeah, no, but definitely both paths are available to our Princeton listeners, especially those in the economics department. I wanted to sort of put your work, both in The Great Escape and then your commentary in Economics in America, in conversation with Robertson Acemoglu's thesis about political institutions, that political institutions are really the most important determinant that we should look at in terms of, you know, in their best-selling book, Why Nations Fail. They're almost inverses, The Great Escape, you know, your book, and Why Nations Fail. But you've been somewhat critical of the notion that by looking at, you know, the success stories of China or India, or looking at countries that have failed to generate growth, that we can glean any sort of generalizable insights about what works and what doesn't. Do you buy that thesis that we really just have to focus on political institutions if we're trying to understand why certain nations are more successful or less successful than others?
I think so. I mean, the differences between me and Acemoglu and Robinson are very small compared with the differences between me and, say, Jeff Sachs, or me and maybe Peter Singer, or certainly the effective altruists, which, you know, he may have founded, but you can't hold them responsible for what they become. So subsequently, I'm very skeptical of the randomized controlled trial movement and the belief that you can generate enough generalizable knowledge from that to really make much of a difference. I'm sure there are places where it helps, but, you know, experiments are useful when they're embedded in some sort of broader set of knowledge. And so that when you discover something from an experiment, it doesn't just tell you that that works there under those circumstances, but it tells you something much broader and more interesting, which can be used more widely. So I'm skeptical of that movement. But the institutions, I mean, obviously there are details in which we disagree, but this centrality of politics, you know, and not having an extractive elite. You know, I like to, when I talk to the effective altruists, I like to give the example of, you know, someone moves in next door, a young couple, and you get to know them, and you pretty soon discover that the man is a very unpleasant person. And he abuses his wife, who he basically uses as a slave. And, you know, he's extracting value from her, essentially. You would like to make the wife better off. So what should you do? And giving the wife money is not very helpful, because you're just giving the man money, right? It might be more helpful to make a deal with the guy, even though that will be enormously distasteful to you, because you're basically allowing him and encouraging him to do horrible things to his wife, if he does slightly less horrible things than he would otherwise. But, you know, that's the situation that you find yourself in with lots of countries. They'll certainly take your money, but they don't, you can't really influence that political bargain which is the centerpiece of the thing. And I mean, in some ways, an institution like the World Bank is very poorly placed because by its charter, it's not allowed to interfere in politics. And, you know, that's the only thing that works. And not that I think you cannot interfere in politics, but it's just, you know, its hands are tied in a way that may be difficult.
Yeah, I wanted to pose sort of one critique that's come up. There was an influential article called The Long, Slow Death of Global Development that was published recently, I think, by a couple grad students at Columbia. But one of the critiques of the political institutions theory is that if you look at probably the greatest success story over the past 30 years, that's China. And China has certain institutions that seem to work, but also by no means has the liberal political institutions that particularly the IMF and economists in the West are trying to inculcate in the developing world. There's not a liberal democracy. State seizure of private property happens sort of routinely. So what would you say to that sort of rebuttal to the importance of politics when China has succeeded so notably without the institutions, the particular institutions that we care about here in the US?
Well, you have to ask yourself, I have a number of responses to that. You have to ask yourself whether China really has been very successful. I mean, it's been very successful in terms of economic growth. But, you know, there are other things that are important in people's lives, which takes me back to my earlier critique about how economics is not just about consumption, you know. And Chinese people may be getting a lot of consumption, but they don't have political freedom and they don't have a lot of things we take for granted and that we would miss very severely if we fell into dictatorship, for example. To come back to the institutional things, when I say I agree with institutions, I'm not sure I know what those institutions are. Less so, that might be somewhat of a difference with Aswell Glowden Johnson. I'm saying that politics are the center of any bargain that you get, which will ensure economic development, right? I'm not saying you have to have X, or you have to have Y, or you have to have a liberal democracy. And I'm certainly was always deeply skeptical of the idea that, you know, if Chinese grew, it would become a liberal democracy, which people hang on to that idea for much too long. So, you know, growth is not everything. And I don't think we're wise enough to say, you know, here's a bunch of institutions, and if you implement those, everything will be all right. That's not true.
Yeah, and so making politics central to our understanding of how globalization and reductions in global poverty should work, it applies both obviously to developing countries whom we're trying to help, but also you've argued to our domestic politics here in the United States. So I read recently what I believe is an excerpt from the new prologue for The Great Escape, which is going to be published by Princeton University Press, or republished this coming year. And so, you know, as you mentioned before, you note that reducing trade barriers that hurt developing countries, you know, is one thing that we can do here on the home front. But you've also noted in your prologue there that this globalization that has helped so many people in the developing world has also generated discontent here at home. And you've suggested that, you know, especially sort of in the wake of the Trump election, that sort of discontent, that we can't go back to the world of globalization that existed before, that we have to accept a new world order in which we listen to those voices that are upset by what they see as, you know, their loss is the developing world's gain. What does that world order look like? And could you sort of expand on how your view on that has changed?
I think I'll make you my spokesman. You're doing a good job on this. excellent. Summary. Yeah. So let me take up one point first, and then I want to come back to the domestic thing. Bob Kahane, who used to be at Princeton, wrote a very wise article about a decade ago saying that you know, international relations now did not depend on international relations at all. It depended on what was happening domestically, right? And so and that's true for foreign aid, and it's true for globalization and all these other things. We tend to think of that in a box called international, but no longer. We have to be thinking about that in a box labeled domestic. Otherwise, if we ignore these domestic things, bad things are going to happen and people are going to come for us. Let me go back to the globalization helped so many people in the world. I'm not sure I believe that anymore, even though everybody says it. They say globalization has taken 1.2 billion people out of poverty since 1990, according to the World Bank statistics. Well, if you look at that, about 75% of it is India and China together, right? And India really doesn't export all that much. So, you know, if you look at the statistics, it's not export-led growth that led poverty reduction in India. In India, there are big problems now because the Modi government is not releasing the data in the way it used to. But nevertheless, there's been a lot of poverty reduction. Much of that has probably been driven by the provision of education and basic services over a long period of time, rather than by exports. So that leaves you with China, which admittedly is a big chunk of it. And there are lots of other smaller countries, still big countries like Bangladesh or Vietnam and so on, where there's been a lot of poverty reduction based on exports. So I'm not denying the possibility for sure. If you think of China, one of the things that's remarkable about China is China saves about half of GDP, right? So if you think about the sort of national income accounting identities, that's a really weird number. I mean, it's a huge number. What are they saving this for? Now, you can tell some stories, but I don't think you can tell enough of to explain it. And various people in China and outside of China have tried. And I could talk about that. But let me just say that, I mean, you can imagine another world in which the Chinese only save 20% of GDP, right? Then what would happen is all that production and all that growth, much of it could have been consumed at home, and it wouldn't have had shown up in Walmart and Target and all these stores around the world. And if that were the case, we could have had all that poverty reduction. It's a hypothetical, and I'm not, this is not my specialty in economics, but you know, if we could have had all that growth in China, all that poverty reduction in China, but without the disruption that we've had in the US, maybe that would have been a good thing. And so, you know, it's not globalization that's caused this horrors in America. It's, you know, the fact that the Chinese say too much, which may be to do with the fact that there's such a wildly unequal distribution of income there, for example. But then come back to home. I think one of the things that economists, and this takes us back to where we were at the beginning, that economists have not been very good at, is, you know, pushing the case for globalization and for trade, which is a deep basic instinct in all economists. You know, you're probably young enough not to have been completely infected by it yet. But there have been skeptics all along the way. And Danny Roderick is someone who's written very wisely about this. And, you know, we're all economists here, so I can use the language I wouldn't always use in public. But the gains from trade are a triangle gain, like a Harberger triangle or whatever you like. You know, there are people who gain and people who lose. And the difference between these two is a triangle, and that's the welfare gain. But if you start from very low tariffs, the triangle gets smaller and smaller. It's always there. But the disruption, the redistribution on both sides of the economy stays enormous. It never vanishes. So what you're doing is doing an enormous amount of redistribution of income, perhaps from workers to Wall Street, not always, but that's something that's been widely claimed, in order to get very small benefits from trade. And so I think we have to rethink that. And of course, you asked the hardest question at the end, which is, what does that world look like? And I don't have an answer to that. And we're going to have to feel our way. Nor do I have to have an answer for that, because no one's telling me, no one's asking me what I have to do. But I think the Biden administration is feeling in that direction. I mean, Catherine Tai, for instance, the trade representative, is certainly thinking along those lines and thinking we have to take other things into account. And this gets back to the narrowness of economics, because we're so obsessed with income or consumption or whatever, that destroying communities doesn't count somehow. Or, you know, losing the power of workers. They used to have unions. They don't have unions anymore. Unions did a lot of good things for working people. They got on the hair of people like us, who are the sort of running global, the governing elite. But nevertheless, that if you don't let working people have some power over their lives, they're going to go for people like Donald Trump, who'll come after us with pitchforks. So, you know, I think we've got to rethink this. And one answer to your question is, what should the world look like? I'd say, well, the world so far really hasn't worked very well. And, you know, we haven't talked about deaths of despair yet, but, you know, there are massive number, the bodies are piling up with people dying from, because suicide rates were approaching this worst suicide rates the world has ever seen. You know, like in Russia and Lithuania, it used to be the champion places where people would kill themselves. And now we're getting in that territory in the US, and never mind all the opioid deaths too. And I think we, Anne and I, interpret that as a symptom of something having gone very wrong with working class Americans.
I want to quickly follow up on some of the domestic issues.
Okay.
Because I really admire what you said about economics becoming more broad. And I had scanned through some of Tyler Cowen's most recent, like the greatest of all time, the GOAT of economics. And he talks about John Stuart Mill and Adam Smith and questions that go beyond like econometric analysis. And I know from your early work that you won the Nobel for, like Almost Ideal, Demand System, Household Survey, you've kind of done that technical work and then also now focused more on the broad questions in your review of the Crisis of the Middle Class Constitution, Why Economic Inequality Threatens Our Republic by Ganesh Sitaraman. You had a New York Times book review where you comment that his concern with inequality undermining the stability of governance is, you know, really a huge, huge problem. That there is this growing divide between the like kind of elites and everybody else. So before we dive into more specifics, I was curious if you could just speak a little bit more about that threat to governance and even some of the solutions that you talk about, including maybe mandatory service in the military or other things to try to work on that.
Yep. Well, you know, I was just reading a draft of, it's not a draft, it's the proofs of a new book from Princeton by David Lay Williams called, I think it's called The Greatest Curse or something. And he traces that worry you've just been talking about, the, you know, once you get, I don't know where that hand comes from, but anyway. He traces back to Plato and Jesus Christ and John Stuart Mill and Smith and so on, this concern that, you know, a republic that gets divided into a rich and poor republic is going to go to war with itself. And, you know, and the concern I would have now in the U.S. is much more between educated people, people who have a four-year bachelor's degree or more, and people without that. And we seem to have made this enormous division there, which I think is putting our democracy in great danger. And, you know, whether it's wealth or consumption, the wages, the things that economists like to think about, but much more broadly, mortality is, you know, life expectancy for people without a four-year degree has been falling since 2010, whereas at least up until the pandemic, it went on for rising for people who had a four-year degree or more. And that division, I think, is just intolerable. I mean, you can't run a country like that. You talked about the military, which many economists, even economists on the left, would argue has been one of the great triumphs of economics, that Milton Friedman persuaded Richard Nixon. Of course, Richard Nixon wanted to be persuaded, but Milton Friedman, who was one of the most persuasive men on the planet that ever existed, persuaded Richard Nixon that we should have an all-volunteer army. But, you know, if you look at who's in the army, the officers all have degrees from West Point or wherever, but the enlisted men and women do not, by and large. And it seems very foolhardy, apart from anything else, to have the people who are going to defend our democracy in the ultimate stakes to be people who, many of whom, don't believe in democracy anymore because democracy has not treated them very well. So that, to me, is the, you know, there's a lot of political scientists who've talked about, you know, if you're a congressman and you're declaring war, if you get the chance, having kids who might have to serve brings the cost of war really home to you. I mean, I remember during the Iraq War, when I realized that my 18-year-old son had the potential to be drafted. And I can tell you, you guys are too young to have that experience yet. But it really, that really hits. And I remember that. And I remember if I were a member of Congress, that would have weighed on me very heavily. It's a lot easier to send members of an underclass off to fight for you than it is to send your own children off. And I worry about that a lot.
No, definitely. That makes a lot of sense. So we also, in preparation, we were looking at your recent conversation with Larry Summers, actually through Princeton. And one of the things that we were thinking about is the idea that, you know, in a democracy, truth requires listening to populations, even when they disagree with some of like the professional academic orthodoxy. And I think there's a lot to that. But to push back a little bit with a recent example, if I think about COVID and vaccines and vaccine adoption, it seems that there was a group of people who tended to be demographically similar to the people that aren't doing well in the United States in some ways, right? Like less educated, maybe more involved with populist politics. And they really came out strongly against the vaccines, even to the point that we saw higher death rates in those groups. So how do we synthesize, you know, an idea that we need to listen to people when they are against kind of the orthodoxy with the fact that in some things, like I would argue the vaccine, they might really be wrong. Is it a communications problem or what do we do there?
Well, the first thing to think about is that, you know, in a democracy, being wrong does not disqualify you from being heard. And if you condescend to people, you know, you get Donald Trump is what you get, you know, and that doesn't seem like a good outcome. Now, obviously, there have been anti-vaxxers, and there's lots of crazies out there, and I don't want to deny that for a moment. But there were a lot of people who weren't crazy who were really marginalized. And I think it was David Leonhardt yesterday who had a piece talking about NIH and how Francis Collins, who was director of NIH, and who's a very, very fine man. I spend a fair amount of time with him and I would trust him with almost anything. But he thinks they got it wrong. And, you know, they didn't spend enough time thinking about, you know, and it's in a way, this really struck me because it's parallel to economists. You know, economists are only concerned with efficiency. Doctors are only concerned with saving lives. Maybe you need a little bit of efficiency and a little bit of life saving. And maybe we'd have done better if that had been recognized along. And, you know, there were things like the Great Barrington Declaration during COVID, which was made by not crazy people, you know, and the NIH bureaucracy, including Collins and Fauci, sort of went after it as if they were Japanese saboteurs during World War II, sort of idea. And I think there are a couple of people here in the politics department, Francis Lee and Steve Macedo, who are writing a book, which is sort of the answer to your question there, which is even during COVID, we would have done better to listen more. And maybe we would have gotten, I'm not sure what I think about that. And I'm not sure that case is as persuasive as the trade case, for instance. Or I think economists were wrong on immigration, for example. And in David Leonhardt's new book, he has a very good chapter on that sort of saying, you know, the populists were right about this and we were wrong. And we should have listened to them more. And there are examples which historians know about that economists don't necessarily know about. You know, in the middle of the 20th century, immigration was essentially shut off into the United States. So if you go back to the Gilded Age, about 14% of the population was foreign born. And that's similar to what we have today. But in the middle, there was this huge dip and there really weren't. And the argument is that the great migration of African Americans to the factories of the North could not have taken place if the factory owners had been able to employ the Serbs and Italians and Germans that they would have preferred. But that was shut off. And so there was this great opening up of opportunity for Americans who'd otherwise not been served very well. So I don't know, maybe I'm just too easy to flip over sort of idea. But I think, you know, the more you look at this, so, but the essence of this thing is you have to listen. You can't say you're not entitled to vote because you're an idiot or because you're deplorable or because I can condescend to you sort of idea. And you've got to prize underneath a lot of the nonsense, and there's plenty of that out there. You know, people are talking about immigrants polluting American blood or something. I mean, that is disgraceful, and there's no way we pay any attention to that. But there's genuine grievances underneath that we do have to think about.
A question on, and at one very elite institution that's run by economists, so I think relevant to what we're discussing. So the Federal Reserve, I mean, hyper elite, right? I mean, appointed, not really democratic, academic economists. When we think about their dual mandate for price stability and full employment, do you think that they've been operating, making the right trade-off in those terms? Or do you think right now is the fact that we still have very high rates an indication that they're not as attuned to the needs of working people as maybe they ought to be?
I don't have a clear answer to that, I'm afraid. And it's partly, I think, the undemocratic critique of the Fed is correct. And Alan Blinder told me recently that Jim Tobin, who's an enormously distinguished economist at Yale, one of the great macroeconomists, had always believed that the Federal Reserve was not democratic and was not under sufficient democratic control. The counter to that, of course, is once you put it under democratic control, all terrible things will happen and you'll get all these cycles and so on. And I think, you know, that Bill Easterly, who we talked about earlier, wrote a book called The Tyranny of Experts. And I like to bait him with that example. I say, do you think there should be no expert joining central banks either? And I don't think he knows the answer to that either, any more than I do. So, you know, you've got a trade-off. I mean, the democratic control would be nice, but the policy would probably be objectively worse.
To expand and transition a little bit into deaths of despair.
Okay.
Which also operates around the theme that the plight of sort of working class Americans and the inequality within the country is one of the biggest challenges that we face. But it takes sort of a slightly different approach than what we've been talking about, focusing on deaths of despair due to suicides, drug overdoses, poisonings as a category. In the books. I wanted to ask a question. Now, it's been several years since The Deaths of Despair was originally published, the original paper, even before that. Has your thesis about the demographic we should look at changed? Because in the original paper and book, it seemed it was more focused on white working class Americans, not Hispanic Americans. And now, in some of your recent more recent commentary, you focus quite a bit on Americans without a college degree. So do you think where we should focus demographically, these deaths of despair, do you think that's changed?
Yeah, I mean, it's 10 years, and if we hadn't learned anything in the last 10 years, we wouldn't be very good researchers. I think the original thesis has held up very well. I was actually in hospital having hip replaced when Anne invented the term deaths of despair. And that's one of these, the ultimate success that people quote the term all the time, but never cite you for it. So that's the sort of punishment that comes with this. My friend Bob Putnam said that he thought that was the best book title he'd ever seen. And as he added, you're talking to the man who invented the title Bowling Alone. You know. So if I can tell you what's changed since then, one of the things that was in the original paper was this division between people with a college degree and without. And so it was clear even in that original paper that the bad things that were happening predominantly, you know, the growth in deaths had been happening among people without a college degree. I think that has become much more important in our minds since, and that's sort of where we would focus now. which is the differing fates of people with and without a college degree. So that's one thing. The white non-Hispanics, that has actually changed in the data. We get a lot of unfair flack for saying, you know, you missed the fact that it was rising among Blacks. Well, it wasn't when we did that analysis. And that was only after fentanyl moved into the inner cities that African-Americans and Hispanics started dying, so that it sort of spread. But it's true that suicides among African-Americans and among Hispanics are much, much lower than among whites. And that's always been true. It's been true since Durkheim wrote in, you know, the 1880s. So I would plead not guilty on that. We couldn't have seen that because it wasn't there. Right? We did do one thing that's wrong. We didn't actually say anything wrong, but it turned out that way, which is that when we saw this rise in mortality among a major group, white non-Hispanics between 45 and 55, and we were looking for what it was, we did what I think was a perfectly reasonable thing to do, is we said which causes of death are rising most rapidly. And those three we found were what became deaths of despair: alcohol, drug overdoses, and suicide. But people then went on to say, and we may even have said it sloppily, that this is mainly due to these things. And it wasn't mainly due to these things. These were the three most rapidly rising things. The big important one was one that was not rising at all, but it had stopped falling. And that was mortality from cardiovascular disease. And that is also largely confined to people without a four-year degree. So we could have included those in deaths of despair too, but we didn't want to sort of go over the top. But that is something that has become clear subsequently. In the last quarter of the 20th century, the thing that was driving down mortality rates and life expectancy up was a decline in cardiovascular disease, much of it from people not smoking anymore, some of it from drugs and so on. And that decline seems to have stopped, and no one knows why. And that's happening in other countries too. But you put these things together, the thing about deaths of despair and why we tend to focus on suicides is just they're all self-inflicted, you know. And the difference between suicides and deaths from drug overdoses are not always clear, as one epidemiologist put it, you know, that he may not have meant to die, but he certainly meant to put that needle in his arm. You know, so you ask yourself, and then the alcohol is obviously a long, slow process in which people are abusing alcohol, and eventually their livers get shot, and then they die. There's also this big increase in morbidity, which was in the original paper. So if you look at all measures of pain, it's going up, and again, predominantly among people without a BA. If you look at marriages, you know, there was a wave in the US where people sort of stopped getting married or got divorced. But for people with a four-year college degree and more, that resumed. And for people without a BA, it did not. So all of these things, which are really important, you know, fathers who've maybe had three sets of kids and don't know any of them in their 40s, it's hard for me to imagine anything worse than that. So there's just all these awful things happening to people without a four-year degree, beyond the economics, and the economics, you know, labor force participation, wages, wealth, all the rest of it, that's sort of happening too. And so we get sort of a bit irritated these days when everybody says, look how well the American economy is doing, it's sort of booming. And that may be true, but it's also booming in death. And, you know, we have a life expectancy that's 5 years lower than most of Europe. And, you know, it used to be pretty much the same in 1980. And it's slowly worsened and worsened and worsened until we're a terrible outlier. And that is being largely driven by people without a four-year degree. Now, of course, these are just the facts. Our interpretation, which is that the world is coming apart for those people and has to do with globalization and automation and immigration and all these things, that's an interpretation. And that's much more controversial, of course, because a lot of people don't want to think about it now.
Yeah, I wanted to. So For our listeners generally, if you haven't heard of the concept of deaths of despair, you will soon if you're at all in tune with public policy, because this has become, especially recently, one of sort of the buzzwords for thinking about the problem of American life expectancy, America's cultural and economic problems. And so I want to pose one sort of critique that's been brought up, you know, in I think the most sort of academically was Carolyn Hawksby's comments on the paper, which is that if we're looking at people with a four-year degree, is it possible that as more and more middle-class Americans have gotten four-year degrees, that those that are left behind are negatively selected? They're the sort of low conscientiousness people. They tend to already have worse health outcomes. Do you think that there are some compositional and selection effects that you have to look out for if we focus on education as our metric?
For sure. You have to look out for them, but we have looked out for them and a lot of other people have looked out for them. And there's an extensive literature, none of which finds this, even though it had been identified for a long time in the sociological, demographic, and economic literature as being a potential problem. I don't know why Carolyn thinks that none of that work is any good. I just find that very puzzling. But in her comments, she said, I reject all of these papers, but she didn't give any arguments. We will certainly look at that a little bit more, but let me just, for your listeners, make a couple of points. One is the selection works for both groups. This is like this old joke that, the students moved from Harvard to Princeton and both places got smarter. And what's happening here is if you take, if the people who are getting educated, the less, the people at the bottom are moving into the educated group, and they're the healthiest group, both groups will get less healthy, right? So it's true that the bottom group should go down, but the top group should go down too. And what happens to the gap, which is in the Brookings paper, what we were talking about, is not hypothetical, is not clear from theory. And in fact, in the paper, we give some examples which can go either way. It can go either way. But as I said, we looked, you find these birth cohorts, a group of people who were born in the same year. You look at them and then you look at the next birth cohort. And in many cases, no change in education at all. And yet you get this widening gap. So we don't think the gap has got almost anything to do with that form of selection. The selection is real enough. Of course, we don't really know. I think it's a big issue for people at the very bottom. It used to be people who had not graduated from high school. That was quite a common thing in 1930. Your grandparents may not have graduated from high school when you were at Princeton, and that would be certainly true of my father didn't graduate from high school. His father certainly didn't graduate from high school. And those were good people. They weren't the halt and the lame or the disabled in some ways. Now, if you don't get a high school degree, there's a much higher fraction of those people who, have a disability of some sort or other, either mental problems or physical problems. And so that group, that bottom group, people who don't have a high school degree, has become much more negatively health selected. And you can see that in the data, that's for sure. But this along the college, BA, non-BA margin, it's not a big thing. There's also almost no difference between people with a high school degree and people with some college, which if you were thinking health selection was very important, you'd expect it to run across the groups. And in fact, the people with some college, this is telling you guys, you better graduate. people with some college are not very different in their health outcomes from people with only a high school degree.
As we can see with the deaths of despair conversation, how we measure data, how we analyze it, it matters a lot. And that's an argument that you have made sort of across your work. In The Great Escape, most recently in Economics of America. I was particularly interested in the 1996 controversy you mentioned over the BLS definition of CPI, Newt Gingrich's sort of right. Crusade to get the CPI measurement adjusted. And so in that way, what seems like an obscure statistical instrument has important policy effects. And so you concluded all data construction has an irreducible political element. So moving more broadly, how can we constructively approach data, and particularly government data, in a way where we're acknowledging the political element, but we also at some point have to accept some set of data and believe it to be true and analyze it? How do you make that balance?
I think through transparency is tremendously important. And I'm always very impressed by the U.S. government statistical services, the BLS and others, and just how carefully they explain what they're doing. That's one thing. The other thing that I think is tremendously important is for people like you guys to be interested in this, right? Because there was a sense in which when I first came into economics, and it would have been true here too, you took courses on measurement. You know, you learned about national income accounting and how to construct the national account. And a lot of that has gone by the wayside. So that you'll find a lot of professors at top schools who wouldn't have the vaguest clue how the national accounts are put together. And I think that's gotten better. I mean, Piketty's influence on that has been very positive. Not just by his own work, but by the people who attacked him and these big controversies over growing inequality and how you measure things. I think that's very, very helpful. And recognizing that there's always a political element is not to mean you should throw it away. It's just that you should recognize that it's a political element and talk about it and discover whether you're putting the rabbit into the hat or whether you've actually found something.
So kind of staying on that topic, I wanted to bring up a recent Bloomberg article by Claudia Sahm, where she discusses some declining rates of response in government surveys. Yeah. And the fact that that might be calling into question, you know, if the data is as good as it usually is. So is that something that you're worried about? And do you think there's any easy solution, or what do we do about that?
I don't know. And it's a real problem. It's odd that America, where you think of as the sort of groups we've been talking about who are against, very dubious of the technical elite, the response rates to the surveys here have been much higher than they are in most European countries, which is always surprising statistic. But they've gotten much worse over time. I did a lot of work with Gallup over the years, and Gallup gave up their telephone polling. Because once they got response rates down in the 10% and less, and a lot of people just absolutely refusing to have anything to do with it, and it's partly because of all the spam phone calls and all the rest of it. Maybe that'll come back when we control spam phone calls, but they've gone to more internet sampling, and in some cases, they actually go to households and talk to people in a really old-fashioned way. So we're struggling with this, and there's no doubt about it. But it's also one of these things where if people are polarized, that worries you because of the bias that it would introduce. And, people on one side are much less willing to answer. I also worry, I think we don't talk enough about opinion polling and political opinion polling. They have nothing else, so they use it. But I think it's really potentially problematic. And the people who answer the phone are the angry people sort of idea, and it's not necessarily the same as the people who are going to go home.
No, definitely. And then also, we just saw a pretty hot core CPI print. But one of the responses has been, the Fed looks at PCE, which allows for substitutions. Some of your work is focused on actually regional price indices, and then some of the econometric works that make them broadly comparable. So if you could just speak a little bit about that, and then maybe programs that look at a local poverty line or a locally adjusted benefits program instead of a federal, like one size fits all solution.
Yeah, a big topic, and I'm not sure I have that much to say. I think you bought too much into the economist's measure, the PCI, the PCE deflator allows for substitution and the CPI doesn't. The difference between these two series is mostly nothing to do with substitution. It's actually to do with the fact that they have very different weights and there's different amounts of health and education and things like that. One of the things that people don't realize is just what enormous share of GDP is imputed one way or another. And, because consumers spend health, but they buy health insurance. And so you know, it's the health that shows up in the national. So there's a big drift between, you know, what people perceive and what they actually see. And I think that's a problem for democracy because, you know, when people see these things, the national accounts, they say, GDP went up, my GDP didn't go up, you know, and so that's a big issue. I have done quite a lot of work on regional price indices as well as on international price indices, which is a whole different kettle of fish. One of the things that drives me insane is the Chinese economy has been bigger than the American economy for more than a decade, and yet the press refuses to recognize this fact. And I don't know, there's a lot of uncertainty, but there is no coherent designed set of price indices which does not give that result. And I don't know whether it's the Chinese who want their economy to be smaller or seem to be smaller, but they're not against growth, but they hate being the biggest economy in the world because that makes them seem like a bully and they want America to be the bully. Or whether it's just that in the anti-Chinese frenzy that we're all living through, we want to make them seem, you know, minimize them. But and that's one of these very technical things, which is hard to make transparent because it's so difficult.
Yeah, I was actually just going to ask about the PPP adjustment. You recount actually in I think The Great Escape, that there was the issue of PPP adjusted GDP or you know, poverty levels. It doesn't just matter for, you know, World Bank reports, but it actually factors in to domestic politics. And one example, in 2011, the World Bank poverty line, PPP adjusted versus not PPP adjusted, was a big part of a debate in India about, you know, how they were doing on poverty. So the press seems to get it wrong on PPP adjusted prices,
right?
And GDP measures. Are economists still getting it wrong? And is the PPP index, like, is PPP adjustment, is it good enough still?
I think it's much better than it was. There was a bad year, which I think was the 2011 round, in which we, and I was involved in that, made a bad mistake in that there's, you can collect pretty good price indices in regions, like in Africa or Asia or Europe or so on. And linking them together is quite challenging. You know, think of the food you'd eat in a Japanese restaurant compared with the food you'd eat in Arizona or something, and you somehow got to compare those. And that's a very challenging thing to do. And I think we made a mistake. But since then, I think it's been pretty solid, and it's not been changing wildly from year to year. So it seems to be under pretty good management these days. I'm not involved in it anymore, so I can say that with a relatively clear conscience. But it's certainly challenging. But the idea that you should use market prices instead, which is what the press does, and what a lot of economists who write in the press do too, is just dead wrong. And, you know, if I'm sure you've been to countries around the world, but you go to a poorer country and you change your dollars for whatever is the local currency, you can buy a lot more stuff than you could buy at home, at least if you don't go to the five-star hotels in those cities. And, you know, that has to be taken into account. Prices are just much lower in poorer countries.
Gotcha. That makes a lot of sense. You know, I was reading a New York Times profile on you, and it said that growing up in Edinburgh, you went to FETS, the school. And that while you were there, actually a big part of the curriculum was listening to and understanding opera. So I'm curious if you think that that's impacted the way you view the world or the way that you think economics should be more combined with like humanistic philosophy. Do you think there's a connection there? Or do you think that's tangential?
That sounds like a bit of a press exaggeration. We certainly went to operas when I was at FETIS, the way it's pronounced. It reminds me a little of my mentor, Richard Stone, who was a fan of the theater and went to the theater in Cambridge to see a one-man show and had invited the one-man show actor back to dinner afterwards. And when I told the New York Times about that, when he won the Nobel Prize, the New York Times said, he liked to go to the theater and invite the whole cast back to dinner afterwards, which was true in that one case. So we certainly did. I remember going to operas. It was a very good school. And I did mathematics there largely because mathematics gave me a lot of time to do the things I wanted to do, which was sports and music and reading. And probably the best teacher I ever had who taught me how to write was a quite amazing, very hard grading teacher who became quite famous subsequently because he became now King Charles's personal advisor for many years. And he spotted Tony Blair, who was his pupil. And then he spotted Boris Johnson and he spotted David Cameron and became headmaster of Eton. So he became quite the most famous schoolmaster in Britain for many years, a man called Sir Eric Anderson, who died a year or two ago. So that was a school that was very good at doing things like that. And the only reason I was there is because my father persuaded teachers to coach me for the exam, since he had no money and the fees there were enormous. It was a place for more or less rich kids. That's an inequality that's much fiercer in Britain than it is here, one of the few, which is the professions, the arts, entertainment, and most sports, though not soccer, are dominated by people who went to private schools. So it's like if, you know, Lawrenceville Academy in Exeter had 80% of all politicians and judges and writers and things. And if you don't go to one of those schools, your chances are much removed. And that's not so unequal here, I think. Though you guys probably went to Exeter or Lawrenceville. No?
Actually, I went to nearby Ewing High Public School. So.
Okay. James has been very quiet.
I went to Trinity, which is, it's in New York. It's not quite the Lawrenceville.
Not quite at the top. Yeah. Okay.
So I want to ask one last sort of fun question.
Which okay. Is
that in a recent interview, you said that you are a recovering teller of scatological Scottish jokes. It's probably one of those things best censored now that I'm a Nobel laureate. You know, our listeners would love to hear one.
Okay. You know, one of the unexpected benefits of winning the Nobel Prize is that I said something like that to a reporter, and people for a long time sent me scatological Scottish jokes. and so I have quite a collection. But I'll tell you my favorite one, which is not so scatological. It's one I really love. I also have a cousin, a woman, who's a sheep farmer in Scotland. And she had not heard this joke either and liked it very much. So the joke is that the Rolling Stones said, "Hi, you, get off my cloud," right? And what did the Scottish farmer say? The Scottish farmer said, "Hi, MacLeod, get off my you." That's a pretty good joke.
I'm a fan, and I'm impressed. It even impressed your relations back in Scotland. So on a sort of broader note, we like to end each of our interviews by asking our guests for one punchline. The name of the show is, of course, Policy Punchline. And so I would just ask, what is one punchline you would leave our listeners, and particularly Princeton undergraduates and those in economics who are looking to get in the field? And of course, we haven't even been able to talk about your career trajectory, but if there are any lessons from your journey from Scotland to Cambridge to Princeton, what's one punchline you would leave us with?
Well, I'm not sure it's a policy punchline, but I keep changing my mind. And some people think that's a really disgraceful thing, but it served me well. And I think there's being open, at least, to having your mind changed is a really important thing. And, you know, economics, there's a really good thing about economics, which is You can be a tenured professor at Harvard when you're 25 years old. You know, it's open to the youth, to people like you. And you don't, in many professions, you have to be my age before you get to say anything that anyone will listen to. And that's not true in economics, and that's a really good thing. And so I have a lot of hope for the future. And it's one of the reasons that I'm enjoying talking to you guys, because that will, you know, you spread that message.
Well, thank you so much for Professor Deaton for coming on. This has been excellent. And to our listeners, this has been Policy Punchline with James Cross and David Pagaro, and hope you listen again next week.
You've been listening to Policy Punchline, a podcast generously supported by the Julius Rabinowitz Center for Public Policy and Finance at Princeton University. We would also like to encourage you to follow other podcasts produced by Princeton University, such as Politics and Polls by the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. Policy Punchline is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Julius Rabinowitz Center for Public Policy and Finance. For more information on subscription, donation, volunteering, or contact, please visit policypunchline.com. Thank you again for listening.